sheriff she teamed up with before was black.
You think the boy was hiding in the house? Jurgen asks.
Maybe in the house.
Dubose's attention shifts to the distant ramshackle barn.
The house, or somewhere on the property.
But why did Hosteen drive his truck into this place?
I don't know everything, Cubby.
He picks up the license plates he previously discarded.
Gotta call Desert Flora, have them run a search of plates scanned on incoming traffic, see where the Suburban came from when it was white.
Just then, an outlandish yet somehow familiar figure appears from around the ruins of the house and says,
Hey now, boys, that there's some ass-kicking truck you got. I'd get myself one if I had more than a pot to pee in, which is about all I got after four lazy squandering husbands and what with the pathetic check I get from the thieving embezzlers at Social Security.
She looks as old as the desert, centuries of hot sun baked into her wrinkled face, long tangles of brittle white hair frizzling from under her wide-brimmed straw hat, dressed in a red neckerchief, a tan linen shirt almost as wrinkled as she is, cargo pocket khakis, and red athletic shoes. She carries a big shoulder-slung purse from which peers a small dog, a Pomeranian that regards Jurgen and Dubose with keen interest.
I figured a fancy-ass truck like yours couldn't stay hid for long in the Anza Borrego. A dandy like that'un must take years of profitable sinning to pay for it. What's the sticker price on that there sucker?
Dubose smiles, though not warmly, and says,
We're FBI, and this is a crime scene, ma'am. You need to leave the property.
She cocks her head and squints at them, and the Pomeranian does the same, as if it mimics her gestures as a parrot might mimic her colorful language.
You boys remember me, broke down by the side of the road in killer heat? You went blowing by like a wind out of hell?
Ah, Jurgen says. Yes, that rust bucket Dodge pickup.
The old woman says,
I come here to tell you a thing or damn two about manners and courtesy, seeing as how your worthless parents never done their job.
Granny, Dubose says, you could get yourself in a world of trouble if you don't vamoose.
Ignoring the implication that she risks arrest for interfering with an investigation, the old woman says,
Maybe some didn't stop because they were on their way to comfort a dying child, but you're not that kind. What blisters my butt is you not only go flying past, but you just got to mock me with a toot-toot. Wasn't me alone might wither and blow away in that killer heat. Was Larry, too.
At the mention of his name, Larry the Pomeranian looks adoringly at his guardian.
This here precious pup is the light of my life. The only one who's loved me in 90 years. You toot-toot me, you toot-toot him.
Dubose has had enough. When the big man has had enough, he is a wonder to watch.
Listen, you stupid, dried-up old twat. You get your skinny ass out of here, or I'll break more bones than you can count, make you watch me crush Larry's head, and then bury you alive in the rubble of this house.
She sighs.
Idiot.
She draws a Sig Sauer P-245 from her monster purse and shoots Dubose twice, point blank. She shoots Jurgen as he goes for his pistol, shoots him again as the weapon falls from his hand. He collapses to the pea gravel. Suffering pain far greater than anything he's ever known or imagined, Jurgen looks up at the old woman as she stares down with disdain.
Rattlesnakes,
she declares.
Shit. I must have killed 1,000 of them.
From Jurgen's perspective, when the shooter turns and walks away, she is not a diminutive old woman any longer, but a towering figure with a mystical aura. His entire life now seems to have been a wandering without purpose, incoherent until she walked in to say,
Hey now, boys, that's some ass-kicking truck you got.
Whereafter, she has defined his life as he's never been able to do, has drawn a red circle around his 37 years and penciled in the margin one word, meaningless. Chapter 15. in case the authorities were stopping all incoming and outgoing traffic at the roadblocks, as they had done little more than 2.5 hours earlier. Cornell Jasperson would leave Borrego Valley in the motorhome, tucked under the platform bed where Luther Tillman had hidden earlier. Travis would occupy the smaller space under the built-in sofa where Jane had been concealed. She helped the boy extricate himself from the duffel bag, and she knelt beside the Suburban to hold him close, to feel the beating of his heart and look into his eyes. They were his father's eyes in every striation, in their crystalline clarity, in the directness with which they met her eyes. "Good so far," she said. "Not much farther to go. Mr. Rigowitz will show you where to hide. He's a lovely man. Do exactly what he tells you to do."
"I will."
"Listen, in there where you're going to hide, there might be this cockroach. Don't let it scare you at the wrong moment."
"Cockroaches don't scare me, Mom."
"I should have said don't let it startle you. Be very quiet and still, and everything will be all right."
"Why can't you hide in the motorhome with us?"
"There aren't enough spaces to hide, sweetie. Besides, Luther and I are going to be Bernie's escort, like a police escort." She hugged him very tight again and kissed his cheek, his brow. "Hurry now. Mr. Rigowitz is waiting." As Luther led the boy to meet Bernie at the starboard door of the Tiffin Allegro, into which Cornell had already climbed, as Jane got to her feet, she heard the helicopter. Chapter 16. Carter Jurgen, lying helpless on a catafalque of pea gravel, under a searing sun as fierce as the eye of some merciless monocular judge, a chorus of crickets singing a monotonous dirge. The agony first squeezes from him screams more terrible than those to which any of the people he's executed have ever given voice. But either his nervous system short-circuits from an overload of pain, or his brain is pumping out a flood of endorphins, for the torment soon subsides to mere misery. He doesn't know exactly where he's been shot, and lacks the courage to assess his wounds. He is too weak to move, and growing weaker by the moment. Bleeding out. He can smell the blood. He is lying on his side, facing Radley DuBose, whom he believes is dead. The big man is sprawled flat on his back, arms out to his sides. Then DuBose speaks.
"An historic moment, my friend."
"Call 911, says Jurgen, as a flicker of hope fires through his unadjusted brain.
"No can do, cubby. I'm paralyzed from the neck down. No feeling at all. Wish I'd called Desert Flora about the bitch hawk before I called the pilot. Now only the pilot knows."
Jurgen begins to weep.
"No tears are warranted," DuBose counsels. "This is a great and noble death."
"Noble?" Carter Jurgen is still capable of astonishment and a small flame of anger.
"Noble? Tell me what the hell is noble about it. We're dying for the revolution."
Jurgen's words come in a rhythm of exhaustion.
"We're dying, 'cause you tooted at a creepy old, crazy old skank demented from a lifetime of vicious heat, tarantulas, snakes, flying bats, eating flying beetles in the night, and 4 useless desert rat husbands who she probably deserved, the hateful bitch."
"Whom, not who,"
DuBose corrects.
"Love the revolution, my friend. It is our monument."
Jurgen's vision is fading. He can draw only shallow breaths.
"It's bullshit. The revolution. Just bullshit."
"All revolutions are bullshit, cubby. That is, until you win one. Then you rule like gods and take what you want, who you want. Meanwhile, man, what a ride."
Jurgen's hearing is fading, too. DuBose sounds distant. He can hardly hear the big man. He whispers an expression of love, such as he knows it.
"You were always so cool,"
How could this happen to you when you were always so cool?
If DuBose answers, Jurgen does not hear him. Chapter 17. The possible evil intentions of those who fly the Airbus H-120 imparted to the aircraft a monstrous quality, so that as it streaked across the desert scrub toward the RV campground, it appeared less like a machine than like a huge wasp with lethal venom to deliver. The Hilo's approach was so direct and fast, Jane could only assume that in the half hour since the pilot left them unmolested at the ruined house, he had found a reason to reconsider their legitimacy and to seek them out. Now he and his crewmate had seen Travis being led to the motorhome, a boy approximately the size of the one they were hunting. Jane pulled open the front passenger door and grabbed the Auto Assault 12 as the chopper racketed over the car, over the Tiffin Allegro, and executed an arc of return. She hated this. She was trained for the street, not for the battlefield. In the Bureau, and even since, when she'd been forced to kill, the enemy had been a person, dimensional and detailed. She had seen his face, had known beyond all doubt that he was malicious and an immediate threat to her life, or the life of an innocent. But this confrontation was of the nature of war, not law enforcement. She couldn't see the faces of the men in the chopper, didn't know their names, didn't, with certainty, understand their intentions. In war, you needed to kill at a distance, at the earliest opportunity. Otherwise, you could be overwhelmed and lose your advantage, and then the fight. But the need to do this made her feel not wicked, not even unclean, but in part responsible, because it might not have come to this if she had been a little smarter, quicker. There was no time for self-examination. She existed only for her boy, to give him a chance at life, and perhaps yet a world worth living in. What laws Jane broke, and what sins she committed in his defense, were a cancer on no one else's soul but her own, and she alone would bear the consequences all the way to the grave, and perhaps beyond. The pilot used the Airbus H-120 as a weapon of intimidation, clearing the roof of the motorhome by no more than 20 feet. Maybe the co-pilot was also a shooter. Jane couldn't know if they were strictly on a surveillance run or might be combat ready. When the chopper crossed the Suburban and turned its flank to her, the starboard door might be open to facilitate automatic fire. Loaded with slugs, the Auto Assault 12 had an effective range of 100 meters. As the Hilo passed over the Suburban far lower than that, Jane moved boldly under it and emptied the drum magazine. With a muzzle velocity of 1,100 feet per second, the shotgun pumped out 32 slugs in 6 seconds. The auto-fire report stuttered loud across the parking lot, but the recoil reduction system was as effective as claimed, the butt plate of the stock bumping against her shoulder not with jarring violence, but as if giving her a rapid series of attaboys to encourage her attack. At such close range, the slugs ripped holes in the aircraft's undercarriage, wrecked one of the skids, rattled hard through the whirling rotor blades to no good effect, tore up the tail pylon, blew out the tail rotor, disintegrated the horizontal stabilizer. 70 or 80 feet past Jane, the Airbus wobbled into an uncontrolled death spin. It came back toward her, and a thrill of terror fired her heart as if it were a drum magazine in her breast. Then the chopper spun away from her, drawing a gray spiral of smoke on the bright air. The engine quit, and the Hilo tipped, and a blade of the rotary wing gouged the blacktop. The Airbus flipped, tumbled, exploded, vanishing in a beautiful bright flower of infinite petals that for a moment seemed to grant pilot and co-pilot absolution in death. But then the broken craft reappeared as a scorched carcass, and the petals of flame became mere tongues of fire that licked through the wreckage with fiendish hunger. Jane turned toward the Suburban. The two dogs were at the side window of the cargo area, neither of them barking. They seemed not to have been frightened by either the gunfire or the crashing Airbus. Their dark, liquid eyes regarded Jane with grave interest, as though in their veins flowed the blood of seers, as if they intended by the intensity of their stares, to convey to her the nature of some oncoming calamity. Luther stood on the farther side of the vehicle.
Shit.
An avalanche of it, she agreed.
You think they had time to report finding us?
Maybe.
They'd be excited, overconfident, caught up in the moment.
They were both aboard the Suburban. The engine of the motorhome turned over, started. Jane said, "We're too deep in for a change of plans. It's this or nothing. Let's roll." Chapter 18. In the bedroom of the Tiffin Allegro, Cornell Jasperson found the secret space under the queen-size bed to be comfortable and even pleasant. He was not having an anxiety attack, but darkness always calmed him in the throes of such an event, and it calmed him now. As when he was burning with anxiety, Cornell imagined himself floating in a soothing pool of cool water. Under the bed platform, where no one could touch him, he wouldn't go nutbar and make a spectacle of himself at the very worst moment, which might have happened if he had remained in the Suburban. The motorhome began to move, slowly at first, and then faster. Engine rumble and road noise filtered up into the secret space where Cornell lay. It wasn't pleasant to the ear, but he could endure it. This wasn't like the sound of the airplane that had touched him all over like thousands of crawling ants and spooked him into an anxiety attack. He would be all right. He really would. Nobody could touch him here. Mr. Rigowitz seemed like a good person, very old but gentle and concerned, a nice smile. When he'd shown Cornell the space under the bed, Mr. Rigowitz said he'd driven from one end of the country to the other over and over again, so he knew what he was doing behind the wheel of the motorhome. He would do a fine job. They were safe in his hands. Nevertheless, Cornell wished that their driver was Mr. Paul Simon, the songwriter and singer. He knew it wasn't realistic to wish for this. Mr. Paul Simon was too famous and probably too rich to drive a bus for anyone, though a constant kindness in his music suggested he would be a person of humility and understanding who would do anything that he could to assist someone in distress. A disturbing thought occurred to Cornell. Until recently, he had worn his hair in dreadlocks like Mr. Bob Marley, the singer, but he cut them off when he learned that the reggae star had been dead for decades. Although he loved Mr. Paul Simon's music, he did not closely follow the singer's life, and now he realized that he didn't know if Mr. Paul Simon was alive or had passed away. If Mr. Paul Simon had passed away, Cornell shouldn't be wishing that the singer-songwriter was driving the motorhome. Mr. Rigowitz was very old, but alive, which made him better suited to the task. Thinking about all this, Cornell became nervous. The darkness and the imaginary pool of cool, soothing water were helpful. But to further calm himself, he began to sing aloud, softly.
Diamonds on the soles of my shoes.
Chapter 19. Jane Hawke knew the desert offered unique beauty, but under the current circumstances, this stark realm seemed to have been salted and otherwise poisoned. What little grew across the pale surrounding plain appeared misshapen and threatening, as though the roots of all the local flora extended far down into infernal regions, originating in the tortured souls of the citizens of that deep darkness. When they had first arrived here, the land had seemed to speak to her, and now she felt that it repeated what it had said then. The boy is mine, now and forever. They had arrived on County Highway S-22, but they were leaving on State Highway 78 to avoid encountering the same agents at the same roadblock. Bernie had entered the valley as ordinary Albert Neary, but he was leaving with an FBI escort, which couldn't be easily explained to those who remembered him from a few hours earlier. Luther drove 5 miles below the speed limit. They didn't want to appear to be fleeing and thereby draw undue interest. In the motorhome, Bernie remained only 3 car lengths behind them. Traffic seemed heavier than normal, nearly all of it outbound from the valley, The motorists who passed the Tiffin and Suburban were traveling much faster than the speed limit. Although nothing about the people glimpsed in those vehicles confirmed their panic, Jane suspected an urgent exodus was underway, inspired by extreme, bizarre violence witnessed and rumored. She had a second 32-round drum for the Auto Assault 12. The barrel of the shotgun was still warm when she changed out the depleted magazine. Whether the search operation had learned that she was in an FBI Suburban, or whether that discovery died with the crew of the Airbus, security at all the roadblocks had surely tightened in the hours since she arrived. The professionals hunting her possessed intuition no less keen than hers. They would feel in their bones that this was the day when she would come, that she was among them, and in fact, that she might already have her boy and be on the way out. Furthermore, they evidently had augmented their searchers with a cadre of adjusted people, and something had gone terribly wrong. The ensuing chaos gave them another reason to conduct tighter searches of every outbound and inbound vehicle. They might even seal off the valley for the duration and allow no one to enter or leave. She couldn't risk the motorhome being subjected to a closer inspection than it had received earlier in the day. She and Luther would try to bluff their way through the roadblock with bureau ID and badges that she'd gotten on Monday from her source in Reseda. Duke and Queenie might give them away. However, the dogs might as likely add credibility to their story of escorting a VIP Arcadian out of the chaos zone. Yes, it was known that Gavin and Jessica Washington owned a pair of German shepherds, but Jane suspected most of these elitist Arcadian creeps would be unable to imagine that she might risk rescuing the dogs along with her boy. Their ethics, such as any existed, were utilitarian ethics. Were their roles and hers reversed, they would abandon the dogs, or even kill them rather than bring them along. Fortunately, Duke and Queenie were of the breed most often trained to assist law enforcement officers, and the Bureau employed a kennel's worth of them. After certain events in Iron Furnace, Kentucky, Luther had been publicly connected to Jane. However, he hadn't been at her side during subsequent hits she made on Arcadians in Orange County, California, and Lake Tahoe. They might think he had died or gone to ground in grief over the nanoweb enslavement of his wife and older daughter, unwilling to risk his remaining child, Jolie, by further helping America's most wanted fugitive. Luther could not disguise his race or his size, but his shaved head, beard, and new wardrobe might be enough to avoid suspicion. As for Jane, she was being Eleanor Dashwood. Shoulder-length blonde hair long gone, pixie-cut chestnut-brown wig, colored contact lenses to turn her blue eyes brown, stage-prop glasses. A simple disguise was nearly always successful if worn with confidence. Never avoid eye contact. When stared at, stare back. When flirted with, flirt in return. Don't evade casual conversations with strangers. In fact, initiate them. Know who Eleanor Dashwood is, and then be her. They were approaching the crest of a low rise when Luther said,
"Something's on fire."
A dark column churned high into the faded blue sky. Three vultures circled the smoke as though it bore the scent of charred carrion that whet their appetite. The Suburban topped the rise. Half a mile ahead, light bars flashed on the barricading vehicles, one of which burned furiously. Chapter 20. The water surging in the gutters bears upon it phosphorescent laces of foam. Deprived of wind, the rain falls hard in plumb lines. Thin scarves of fog do not race like the rain, but instead wander through the day to a different tempo. Like lost spirits seeking some final resting place, glowing with the lightning as if each bolt is a welcoming call that lures them toward some far shore. The scene is beautiful, and it is crafted solely to enhance the drama of what Egon Gottfried will soon do, yet he's weary of it. Here in eastern Texas, in the central time zone, perhaps half an hour of daylight remains, but the dark gray overcast is so thick that the sun seems already to be setting behind the swollen clouds. He is eager to proceed, and would approach the target house now, if only the storm would relent. A moment later, the volume of rain diminishes, becomes a light drizzle. The drizzle becomes sprinkles. The arsenal of heaven seems to have fired its last thunderbolt. In the gathering gloom, the rain entirely stops. Chapter 21. Luther said,
"This doesn't look good."
Vehicles had been ordered off the road and were parked on the flanking desert, three long parallel rows beside the outbound lane, many fewer along the inbound side. Agents wearing FBI t-shirts and baseball caps were carrying riot guns and watching over the restive motorists in their cars and trucks. The bureau boys looked pissed, as though they wouldn't hesitate to shoot out tires, maybe even a windshield, if one of the drivers they'd ordered into limbo decided to tramp on the accelerator and take off. Jane said, "If we are who we say we are, we'll play it bold. Drive straight into it, but slow." In the eastbound lane, a disabled Dodge Charger, which perhaps had been serving as a barricade, had been T-boned at high speed by a Cadillac Escalade. The Charger was on its side, afire. The front doors stood open on the caddy. Evidently run down by the Escalade, two mangled corpses, one male, one female, lay in the eastbound lane. As Luther pulled around the dead to proceed slowly eastbound in the westbound lane, an armed agent waved him vigorously toward the shoulder of the highway.
"We're coming straight at them, so they can't see the FBI on the roof and doors," Luther said.
"Or maybe the Airbus pilot got the word out and these guys are onto our game." Jane put down the window in her door as Luther lowered his. She held out the badge in her right hand, raised high for all to see, as Luther offered his in his left hand. The agent still waved them insistently to the side of the road, and two other men warily moved forward with their shotguns raised, one to each flank of the Suburban. With the motorhome close behind, Luther braked to a stop, but didn't leave the pavement. The Auto Assault 12 stood between Jane's knees, butt on the floor, muzzle aimed toward the ceiling. Under the circumstances, it availed her nothing. Any attempt to use it would draw instant fire from the two approaching agents. The man who came to the driver's side saw FBI on the door, but he didn't lower his weapon. Blood spattered his face, maybe not his own blood. From a distance, Jane had thought these men looked angry, and they did, but they were also terrified, wide-eyed and as pale as soap, wound so tight that if a neural spring failed, there could be unintended shotgun fire.
"What's happened here?" Luther asked.
Staying three steps back from the driver's door, the agent spoke as if Luther's simple question was an affront.
"What happened here? What do you think happened here? What's it look like happened here? Freaking zombies happened, like they're happening everywhere."
The agent on Jane's side said,
"In like 10 seconds, one of our guys had its face chewed apart, torn off. What kind of crazy bastard can do that, can even think of doing it?"
Luther said,
"That's why we've been ordered to escort the man in the motorhome the hell out of here."
The bloodied agent looked toward the Tiffin Allegro.
"Who's he? He gets an escort."
"Better you don't know a name. There's no revolution without him. He's from the Central Committee."
Jane leaned toward the console and looked through the driver's door window at the agent. She didn't have to fake anxiety. Her voice was shot through with fear for her boy. "Hey, listen. The guy in the RV is a mean ballbuster. You want to know who really runs the DOJ and the Bureau, pulls the strings? It's not the Attorney General or the Director. It's that son of a bitch back there. If we don't get him out of here fast and then something goes wrong, we'll wind up with needles in our arms. Maybe you have bigger worries right now, but number one with me is being injected and brain-fucked. So can you just, damn it, please cut us some slack?" The agent glanced at the Tiffin again, then quickly away, as if the man up there behind the wheel might curse him with the evil eye. He was harried, shaken, thrown off his game by recent weird events.
All right. Go on through. But slow. It's a mess.
Although Luther and Jane had been granted permission to proceed, the other agents watched them with sharp suspicion as they passed. Beyond the wrecked Cadillac and the burning Dodge Charger, four more bodies were splayed on the pavement, two perhaps cut down by gunfire, at least one of the others butchered in a manner that Jane could not discern. Small flying insects of a species unknown to her had ventured forth from their shadowed havens into the desert heat, enticed by the feast of fresh blood. Wings silvered by sunlight, they swarmed in shimmering hysteria above the dead, and the burning car smoked into a sky as pale and dry as the land below. Beyond the windows of the impounded vehicles alongside the highway could be seen stricken faces, drivers and passengers who seemed as patient as spectral voyagers waiting on the bank of that final black river for the ferry that forever conveyed travelers in only one direction. As the scene of horror and chilling portent receded, Jane felt no relief. The junction of State Highways 78 and 86 lay about 20 miles ahead, and the town of Indio, where they would return to the comparative safety of Ferrante Escobar's fenced property, was almost another 50 miles farther. In 70 miles, in this new wicked world aborning, anything could happen. Chapter 22. In all likelihood, the downpour ceases only temporarily to facilitate Egon Gottfried's approach to the target house. Once he gains entrance to the residence, no doubt the unknown playwright will cue the lightning and thunder, crank on the spigot, and flood the scene with storm effects once more as this act of the drama moves toward its violent, Wagnerian conclusion. Carrying the MedExpress container and a tote bag, he crosses the quiet street to the house that stands three doors south of the one where Ansel and Claire Hawk abide in a false sense of security. He turns north. The storm in intermission clots and blackens the sky no less than during its performance. The early dusk it has brought to Conroe becomes darker with each step that Gottfried takes. The following is what he knows by dint of extensive use of NSA data troves and connections. Sue Ann McMaster, born Sue Ann Luckman, the clerk at the bus station in Killeen, was once married to Roger John Spencer, her first husband, for 8 months prior to his death in a traffic accident. Roger's mother is a Mary Ann Spencer, now the manager of the bus station in Beaumont, who presented Egon with the staged video of Ansel and Claire stand-ins arriving from Houston. Tucker Tredmont, the young Uber driver with man breasts and a snarky attitude, who led Egon, Rupert, and Vince out of Beaumont to an abandoned house in the boonies, is the son of Arnett and Corey Tredmont. Arnett's maiden name is Lemon. She is the daughter of Lisa and Carl Lemon. Carl is Lisa's second husband. Her first was one Bobby Lee Bricker. Lisa and Bobby Lee, now in their 70s, had a child all those years ago and named him Lonnie John. Lonnie John Bricker isn't only the half-brother of Arnett Lemon Tredmont, but is also the driver who, during a Skype interview with Gottfried, claimed that Ansel and Claire Hawk were passengers when, on Monday, he drove the 1025 bus from Killeen to Houston. This leaves Jim Lee Cassidy, the tall, folksy, white-haired realtor and lying sack of shit in Killeen, who claimed that Ansel and Claire had been getting out of the Mercury Mountaineer in front of his office when his valise fell open, spilling a lot of important papers. Supposedly, they helped him pick up the documents before the wind blew them away, and then they hurried off in the direction of the bus station. Jim Lee Cassidy is surely the wily bastard who worked out this chain of deception. Sue Ann McMaster and her husband live in a house in Killeen that they acquired through Cassidy, as do Lonnie John Bricker and his partner. Arnett and Corey Tredmont had lived in Beaumont, where their son Tucker still resides, but they later moved to Killeen, where they bought a house through the ever-busy Jim Lee Cassidy. The links between Cassidy and the Hawks were more difficult to uncover. Jim Lee has an older sister, Corinna June, 70, who is married to one Preston Eugene Fletcher. Preston Fletcher has a twin sister, Posey, who is married to one Johnny Don Ackerman. Posey and Johnny Don have two daughters and a son, all grown. The son is Dr. David Ackerman, 42, a military historian and a civilian employee at the Corps Combat Development Command at Quantico, to which Nick Hawk had for a while been assigned. There, Nick met Jane. Those are facts known to Gottfried, and the following are suppositions he makes from those discoveries. Nick and Jane Hawk were friends with Dr. David Ackerman at Quantico. Subsequent to Nick's death and Jane's ascension to the most wanted fugitive list, David Ackerman discreetly contacted the Hawks to say that he wanted to help any way he could, and Jane vouched for him to her in-laws. At some point, it was decided that Ansel and Claire might one day need a bolt hole and a plan to obscure the journey they would make to get to it. David Ackerman's parents, Posey and Johnny Don, now retired, made a lot of money in the construction industry in Conroe. They lived in a large house on 3 acres, but owned as well a vacation home in Florida, where they spent part of the year. Whether they were home in Conroe or not, they were pleased to allow Ansel and Claire to hide there if and when the need arose. So Ansel and Claire didn't drive the Longrins Mercury Mountaineer to Killeen. Say they drove it as far as Austin. Say they were met in Austin by Dr. David Ackerman's sisters, Kay and Lucy. Say Kay drove them 4 hours to the house in Conroe, while Lucy drove the Mountaineer to Killeen and parked it in front of the real estate company owned by her uncle, Jim Lee Cassidy, who then waited for the authorities to tie the Mercury Mountaineer to the Hawks and locate the vehicle by its GPS signal so that he could send them to Sue Ann McMaster and the bus station. Texas isn't real, and neither are Texans, but Egon Gottfried hates the state and its people nonetheless. There's no point hating the unknown playwright who created Texas and Texans, because when all is said and done, this has been conceived as a dramatic vehicle in which Gottfried will triumph and achieve greatness as an iconic loner. But though he doesn't hate the UP, Gottfried does sometimes wonder about his, her, its mental state. Now the street darkles under the paused storm. He arrives at the Ackerman property. Posey and Johnny Don are in Florida. Although the daughters, Kay and Lucy, will do all errands for Ansel and Claire so that the fugitives can remain in the house and not risk being recognized, the siblings will now be at their own homes with their families. Gottfried follows the long driveway to the house. The landscape lights, evidently on a timer, are not yet lit. Immense pine trees overhang the driveway. All is secluded, dark, and quiet, except for the rainwater that drips from the branches of the pines. The house has a security system, provided by Vigilant Eagle, Inc. It no longer works. From his hotel suite in Beaumont, using a laptop, via the NSA, Gottfried had entered the Vigilant Eagle computer system by a back door. From there, he'd accessed the computer that the alarm company had installed in the Ackerman house to monitor and ensure the proper response condition was at all times maintained by door, window, motion detection, and glass break sensors. He did a bit of fiddling. The readouts that are part of the alarm keypads throughout the residence continue to show a properly functioning system, but when he forces entry, no alarm will sound, and no alert will be received at Vigilant Eagle's central station. He circles the imposing house, studying it. A few lights brighten windows upstairs. The only lights downstairs are toward the front of the residence. Some windows are covered with draperies, or at least shears, but others allow him views of the interior. He doesn't see anyone. The kitchen at the back of the house is dark. Rather than a porch, there is a large covered patio. By the back door, he puts down the MedExpress carrier and the tote bag. From the tote, he withdraws a Lockaid lock-release gun that will automatically pick any deadbolt. This device isn't entirely silent. He will need to pull the trigger a few times to cast all the pins to the shear line. In a quiet house, the clicking noise might draw attention. He can hear no music, no television. When he hesitates, the storm abruptly resumes, rain hammering on the patio roof. Godfrey smiles. There is no lightning or thunder at the moment, but the rataplan of rain will mask what noise the lock release gun makes. He uses a penlight, on and quickly off, to locate the keyway in the deadbolt. He inserts the thin pick of the gun. He needs to pull the trigger 5 times to disengage the lock. He puts away the Lockaid. From the tote bag, he removes a taser pistol and a spray bottle of chloroform. Leaving the tote and the cooler of ampules on the patio, he enters the kitchen and eases the door shut behind him. His long-building frustration is about to be relieved. To get information about Jane and her boy, he needs only to inject one of her in-laws, which will be Ansel. If Claire is still the looker that Lonnie John Bricker says she is, he will use her and then beat her to death with his collapsible baton. His eyes are sufficiently dark-adapted that he has no fear of setting a foot wrong and making noise. Besides, he is the lead of this drama, every line of every scene crafted to serve him. On the farther side of the kitchen, a door to a hallway stands half open, soft light beyond. He circles the kitchen island. The susurration of the rain in the night, the hum of the refrigerator. 2 glowing digital readouts mark the time on the stacked ovens. He is 2 steps short of the half-open hallway door when the cold muzzle of a gun is pressed to the back of his head. Startled, Godfrey lets the bottle of chloroform slip from his left hand. A man with a deep voice says,
"Drop the taser, too. Don't mind doing my share of housework, but I don't want to be mopping up your brains from this nice mahogany floor."
Godfrey drops the taser.
"How many others?"
the man asks.
"Other what?" "Other pestilential specimens like you."
"There's only me," Godfrey replies, trying to imagine how the UP is going to get him past this reversal of fortunes and allow his inevitable triumph by the end of this act.
"Only you," says the gunman. "Not damn likely."
"I'm an iconic loner," Godfrey declares with some pride, "like Dirty Harry or Shane." The gunman is silent for a moment, but then says,
"Loner my ass. You're a creature of the hive if ever there was one."
Chapter 23. 3 minutes after Luther Tillman parked the black Suburban at the back of the fenced compound, Ferrante Escobar's men had pulled off the forged federal license plates, identifying it as Department of Justice ordnance. 1 minute after that, they'd moved the vehicle into the paint shop to strip it down and repaint it neither white nor black, maybe Sahara sand or Grecian blue. In anticipation of the rescue party's success, Ferrante's uncle, Enrique de Soto, had gifted Jane and her team with a bottle of Dom Perignon, which all along had been chilling in the Tiffin Allegro's refrigerator. There was a large bottle of root beer for Travis.
I would prefer root beer, too, said Cornell,
who did not stand with them, but sat apart in a chair that was too small for him.
"Root beer, please and thank you."
A card from Ricky came with an offer to take back the Tiffin and the Suburban, for which Jane had paid $120,000 cash. He'd give her a $50,000 credit toward whatever future purchase she might make. He proposed an alternative deal in which she would receive $90,000 in credit instead of $50,000, but the terms were onerous. Jane was and wasn't in the mood for a brief celebration. She was inexpressibly grateful to have Travis safe with her. However, in truth, no one in her company would be safe for long, and she needed to decide on other arrangements for him. Whether she felt like a celebration or not, she knew the value of one. The essential sense of camaraderie it generated, the hope that it inspired. They sipped the icy champagne from plastic cups, and Travis had his root beer, which he shared with Cornell, while the dogs drank water from a bowl and ate peanut butter treats and repeatedly explored the motorhome, wagging their tails and delighting in a banquet of smells that no human nose could detect. Neither Jane nor Luther nor Bernie nor probably Cornell could shake the foreboding with which the events of the past few hours had left them. Their laughter was muted. What toasts they made were modest and too solemn for a celebration. She loved these three men for their courage, their loyalty, their kindness, but she could not keep her eyes from Travis. If the sight of the boy filled her with gratitude, it also settled on her a sadness close to grief, because they would so soon need to part. Chapter 24. After flying Luther to Palm Springs in his Learjet and then driving him to Ferrante Escobar's place of business earlier that day, Leland Sackett had returned to Palm Springs in his rental car to wait for a call. Now, he was once more en route to Indio. Before this day was done, he and Luther would fly back to the Sackett home and school in Texas. Jolie Tillman waited there for her father, in the company of scores of orphans, wondering if she would soon be one of them. Jane walked with Luther to the guardhouse near the entrance to Ferrante's compound and explained why Travis would not, after all, be going to Texas with him. "I hope to God these techno-Arcadian bastards don't find you and Jolie there. I don't think they will. I think the link between the Sacketts and Nick's family is too obscure for them to smell it out. But if they do... This is awful and selfish of me, Luther, but I've got to say it anyway. If they do smell out that connection and find you and Jolie there, they will inevitably find Travis. I've never met your Jolie, but I know I'd love her, and I love you. I can't have all three of you in one place. I can't lose all of you in one moment. Besides, there's the issue of Cornell."
He said, "I've been wondering about that."
"It's truly amazing how Travis has bonded with Cornell in such a short time. He's going to be devastated if I send him somewhere different from where Cornell goes. He's a strong little kid, but he isn't stone. He's lost so much. He can't lose Cornell, too."
"Maybe Cornell can't handle losing him, either."
She smiled. "I think you're right." The early April afternoon began to submit to a sunset that gilded the fleecy clouds in the west, and a warm breeze issued out of the north, bearing on it something like the scent of orange blossoms.
"But Jane, Cornell can't take care of Travis long term."
"No, he can't. Anyway, soon they're going to find his library for the end of the world, his bunker, and they're going to know he harbored Travis. And after that, he'll be almost as wanted as I am. Do you realize how much they'll torture him just by touching? Poor Cornell has no defenses against people like them."
"But where?"
"Bernie had a talk with me. He says his daughter, Nasia, and her husband, Segev, have a big house on a double lot in Scottsdale. The property is very private. No one has to know there's two new residents. Travis and Cornell will each have his own room, and Bernie says they love dogs, they have one of their own, so Duke and Queenie are welcome. Nasia and Segev, they've been wanting Bernie to give up driving from one end of the country to the other, and now he has even more reasons to stay in Scottsdale. They'll like that."
"But do they know what they're getting into? Who you are? The risks of taking in Travis and Cornell?"
"Bernie told them about the little adventure we had together a couple of weeks ago, the night I carjacked him, and the next day at Ricky DeSoto's place in Nogales. He didn't know who I was then, but later he saw me on TV, and he put it all together. They know where he went today, and why. He says they're half expecting they might have visitors. Luther stood amazed.
How extraordinary.
More than you know. Bernie was a child in Auschwitz. He lost his parents there.
My God.
He told me a little while ago. It's a miracle he survived, thrived, became the sweet, optimistic man he is. He understands what totalitarianism is, from the right, from the left. He knows the evil of these Arcadians and knows this is war. There's no retreating from it. He says not to take in Travis and Cornell would be to shame himself forever and soil the names of his mother and father. He says that Neja and Segev feel the same, and if they didn't, he couldn't abide them, even though Neja is his only child. If I can't trust Bernie, then this is a world where no one can be trusted. Just then, Leland Sackett pulled up to the guardhouse in his rental car. Jane felt as though everything was slipping away from her. All those she loved, the past, the future, the light of the day, and all other light that it represented. She put her arms around Luther and held him very tight, and his arms were strong around her as they said their goodbyes. She waved at Leland Sackett and stood watching the two men drive away, stood watching the highway even after they were out of sight, stood watching as the gilded clouds grew as red as blood in the west. And then she walked back to the motorhome before the night came all the way down. Chapter 25. In the Tiffin Allegro, she settled with Travis on the queen-size bed and held him and listened to him talk of Cornell's good sandwiches and coconut pineapple muffins and Coca-Cola in Atlanta and Mr. Paul Simon and the problem with leaving your toothbrush on the bathroom sink. He was trying to buy time with his stories, keep her with him by the power of his voice. He'd known they wouldn't yet be together permanently again as they had been in Virginia before his dad died, but he had hoped to have a few days with her, not just a few hours. When it was time for him to join Bernie and Cornell in Bernie's Mercedes E350, they moved from the bed to the front door in stages, parting in baby steps, pausing for him to ask questions.
Will you come visit us?
You know I will.
When?
As soon as I can.
Will you get the bad guys? They killed my dad?
Am I FBI or what?
You're major FBI, he said.
He didn't know the depth of the ocean of trouble in which she swam, didn't know that she was America's most wanted fugitive, the beautiful monster of 10,000 newscasts hunted by legions.
Do you think Hannah's okay?
He asked. Hannah was the pony that Gavin and Jesse had gotten him soon before they'd had to go on the run with the boy. The pony had been left behind. Hannah's being well taken care of, honey.
Will I see her again one day?
I'm sure of it, Jane lied.
I was getting real good riding her. Uncle Gavin said I was going to be a real horseman.
Which you will be. I've no doubt about it.
Even rodeos, you think?
In Nick's youth, he had competed in rodeos. Even rodeos, Jane said. At the car, he held fast to her. She didn't know if she could get him to let go. She didn't know if she could make herself let go. In the end, because she was who she was, and because he was his mother's son, they did let go. She watched the Mercedes drive away into the night, as she had watched Luther and Leland drive away in the light of sunset. Watched until there was nothing to see. Then she loaded all her gear from the motorhome into her Ford Explorer Sport. Chapter 26. Egon Gottfried sits at a desk in a book-lined study, Six men stand at various points in the room, watching him. None of them is Ansel Hawk. They say that one of their friends is already driving the Rhino GX to Austin, where he will strip out the GPS and then abandon the vehicle. This does not concern Gottfried. After all, the Rhino cannot be proven to exist, and neither can Austin. The room in which he sits is also an illusion. He needs only to think of what must be done to put him in sync once more with the intentions of the unknown playwright, and all will be well. From time to time, one of the men questions Gottfried, and they remain half convinced there are others in the night with whom they must deal. His answer is always the same, the five words he knows that the UP wants to hear from him. I am an iconic loner. Almost an hour after Gottfried was taken captive, Ansel Hawk finally appears. He carries the MedExpress cooler that contains the control mechanisms in ampules of amber fluid. As Ansel places the cooler on the desk, lightning rips the fabric of the night and thunder speaks against the window glass. One of the other men says,
Ben can do that, Ansel. You keep Claire company. Hold her hand.
Claire Hawk appears in the doorway. I don't need my hand held. And we can't ask any of you to do a thing like this.
The bastard deserves it, another man declares.
He no doubt does, Claire says. But this is going to be on no one's conscience but mine and Ansel's. The readout on the MedExpress cooler reports a temperature of 47 degrees. The control mechanisms are still viable. An uneasiness arises in Egon Gottfried. Ever since he shot Rupert Baldwin and Vince Penn, he has assumed that this drama is a stirring story of his dedication to the revolution, his genius for sleuthing, and his skill at violent action. As he watches Ansel Hawk open the cooler, and as dry ice vapor steams from it, a dark thought crosses Gottfried's mind. Could it be that the UP has taken a detour into Shakespeare territory? The land of Macbeth and Lear and Hamlet? Could this be not at all what Gottfried has thought? Could this be a tragedy? Chapter 27. Jane sat in the Explorer, near the Tiffin Allegro, in the dark, with the engine running and the air conditioning blowing hard. She needed to leave this place, but she could not drive. She had wept as profoundly as this when she found her mother dead, when she lost Nick, but never otherwise in nearly 28 years of life. Those first two times, she wept from mortal cause, her mother lost, her husband gone forever. But her precious child was not lost, and she despised this sobbing, not because it revealed a fatal weakness in her, but because it seemed to tempt fate. Even though she didn't believe in fate, she felt that crying this hard, letting grief so rack her, might somehow ensure that this weeping was for Travis in advance of his certain death, that she was losing him by crying so hard for him. When Ferrante Escobar knocked on the window in the driver's door, she told him to go away, but he would not go. He bent down, staring in at her, until at last she lowered the window. I'm all right, Ferrante. I don't need anyone to talk to. Just a minute. A minute or two. And then I'll go.
I have nothing to say to you, Jane Hawk. I'm not a man of words. I just thought... You might need a hand to hold.
Because of the disturbing paintings in his office and what his uncle, Enrique, had called his obsession with blood, she thought the moment would be creepy when she gave him her hand, but it was instead surprisingly tender. He stood there for a few minutes, his grip gentle, though hers was fierce, and her tears passed. When she let go of him, he walked away into the dark. She put up the window and shifted the car into gear, and drove out of Indio into Palm Springs. She found a motel and paid cash for a room and took a long shower as hot as she could tolerate. When she dressed, she assumed the identity of Leslie Anderson, using an ash blonde wig, lenses that turned her blue eyes gray, and a fake mole the size of a pea, which attached to her upper lip with spirit gum. Leslie wore too much makeup and smashbox lipstick. Before she went out for dinner, she turned on the television and checked a cable news network. There had been a terrorist attack in, of all places, rural Borrego Valley. It was believed that the area's water supply had been contaminated with a powerful animal tranquilizer, related to phencyclidine, angel dust, but 100 times more powerful, that had inspired acts of extreme violence.
Yeah, right.
In a corner booth in a quiet restaurant with low lighting, she ate a filet mignon with sliced fresh tomatoes, asparagus, haricots verts. She drank 2 glasses of good Cabernet. She was too exhausted to sleep. She walked residential streets for 2 hours under the benediction of the infinite and eternal stars. Minute by minute, and step by lonely step, as surely as her lungs drew life from the air, her mind drew from the night and all its wonder, drew from it the increasing conviction that she was born for this fight, and that she would not lose it. She had compiled and secreted away a lot of evidence. She knew what she needed next. She didn't know how to get it, but she would figure that out. Bernie Rigowitz had survived Auschwitz, and in spite of all his losses, he stood now with her. Mishpocha. He was proof that though evil could win in the short term, it could be defeated in time. She had no illusions. Her life hung by a thread. She was no more special than anyone else. Over the millennia, billions upon billions of people had died, been remembered briefly, been forgotten, and they were now gone as if they'd never existed. She was merely another among those billions. But just as she had no illusions, so in this matter she had no choices. She could be only who she was, could do only what she had always done. And one thing she had never done was surrender. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Forbidden Door by Dean Koontz, performed by Elizabeth Rogers, directed by Adam Stovall. Performance copyright 2018 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.